Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is an MCrypt podcast. Well, actually, it's not. It's a recording of a lecture by my friend Chris Hicks. Chris is an emergency physician and trauma team leader in Toronto with a specific interest in stress inoculation, team dynamics, human factors, all sorts of good stuff that goes along with the mind of the resuscitationist. And he gave this lecture. We invited him to come down to New York and give this lecture on team performance, and it was amazing. And so I wanted to put it out here, so I'll put it up here. In lieu of the podcast today, I'll do some wheeze this week. If you're just hankering to hear from me, I got some stuff I want to talk about. But let's hear from Dr. Hicks, and he'll be writing articles on MCRIT soon, so if you like what you hear here, you'll be hearing more from him shortly. Enough from me, Dr. Chris Hicks on team performance.
Disclosures. So my lab, it's not a pig lab, it's a simulation lab, and we do most of our work with simulation-based experiments in education as our lab and as our instructional tool. And what you see behind you are, by and large, education grants that our group has gone out and fetched. I want to emphasize, of course, this is the work of a pretty big group of people in our sim lab, not just me. And I'm beholden to the work that they do. None of these grants pay me directly. It's just to support our research. I wish they would. I've asked them to. I get no money at all from it, and I don't know why. So those are my disclosures. My other disclosure, since Scott embarrassed me a little bit, I'm going to embarrass Scott. I'm a fairly unapologetic MCRIT fanboy and Scott Weingart fanboy. And it's of course, love all the work he does, like thousands of other people do. It's a real privilege to be asked by him and to be asked by the committee to speak here. It's intimidating as all hell to be up here in front of somebody you consider a mentor, but I'm going to give it my best shot. The title of the talk, The Fog of War, derives its name from a military concept about how, even though the best laid plans, the most robust tactical planning can completely fall apart when it hits the ground on the battlefield. And this is Robert McNamara. He's a former U.S. Secretary of Defense, described as the architect of the Vietnam War and had instrumental roles in foreign policy during the Vietnam conflict and during the Cold War era. And the movie of the same name, The Fog of War, if you haven't seen it, it's actually a really fascinating thing to watch. And he looks back quite reflectively on all of these things that happened during wartime and during peacetime that nobody ever really intended to have happen. And he attributes it, this, at least in part, to this concept of the fog of war, the uncertainty that can prevail when chaos reigns. Now, we're not fighters, we're clinicians for the most part, but our environment at times can resemble the battlefield, and this was Paris last year. And I don't know about you guys, but when I watch these events unfold on TV, first thoughts are, with the victims and the friends and the family and so on, and then, like many of you probably, I thought a lot about what the medical response to this must have looked like, or what it would have been like to be a part of it. And that's one of the weird things about emergency medicine, I think, is we run towards stuff like this, right? There's a sort of a weird sense of, well, wouldn't it have been interesting to be a part of that? And this was actually a fairly well-coordinated response across, a city-wide event with multiple casualties. And if you read about the description of how this unfolded, it was actually quite remarkable and well-coordinated. But you can only imagine, at least initially, the sort of chaos and confusion that reigned during a response of this nature. How about this? I'll just kick the volume up. Seen the Hurt Locker? Fairly routine operations for these guys. I think the volume is dialed down a little bit. Doesn't matter a little bit. They're just defusing a bomb, an IED. They're talking about their grass company. They're going to grow grass. No big deal. Now, your cognition during situations like this is kind of focused on identifying atypical features. If you imagine this being a resuscitation, you're scanning your environment for things that look abnormal, like a guy with a cell phone who isn't supposed to be there. The question becomes, in part, when you identify something atypical and unusual, how do you respond? What do you do? Can you act? Yikes. pretty intense. Okay, one more video to show you. So this video is up on YouTube, and actually I commend the team that posted this for posting what looks like a very challenging resuscitation for all of them. This is a what you might describe as a failed airway scenario in a patient, looks like a trauma patient, where they try and intubate from above, they fail and they move on to a surgical airway. There's actually a lot to like about this, and I won't dissect the video completely, but I just want to show you a couple of minutes of it. In particular, pay attention maybe less to the procedure and more to what you hear, the sounds in the room, what the operator's hand looks like as they're trying to intubate, how much sense you'd be able to make of what it was that was going on. So that's a staff anesthetist attempting the initial intubation. Doing the Hail Mary two-hander. I don't know if you can appreciate the tremor there on the operator hand. And then the somewhat desperation tube crammage maneuver, which we see in all the test books, right? Tube doesn't pass, cram it as hard as you can. I don't know if you appreciated the intrinsic team danger there involved in slipping a scalpel right over your finger. But they get in the airway, and they actually, as the video carries on, you'll see they actually are able to capture the airway successfully. I don't know what the actual time lapse was for this, but they got there. I just want to end with the face of the staff anesthetist here. Not a calm and relaxed person, and why would he be, right? And what a challenging situation that must have been for all the people involved. But I don't know if I sort of pulled the audience, you would probably tell me that you heard there's a lot of like, get me that thing with the thing on it, it's over in the place over there, and we need the stuff and that guy, and I don't know, by listening to that, I don't know if you could readily identify who was sort of in charge, who is giving instructions, who is ultimately responsible. And I think to be realistic, we could probably all reflect on resuscitations of our own and think that some of our circumstances have looked a fair bit like that, right? This is not just this team. This is probably all of us at some point when we've been maxed out. So I'm not gonna talk too much about crisis resource management, except to say this is a concept that our group has looked at fairly extensively, at least early on in our research program. The best way to describe this came to me, and this is a true story, when I was reading Curious George to my son. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Curious George books, but Curious George goes to the chocolate factory. In that particular episode, Curious George climbs down onto the conveyor belt, and he pulls the lever, and then the chocolates start flying out really quickly, and you can't really see it up there, but somebody says, quick, bring more boxes, somebody yelled, and then somebody said, what happened? And said, I don't know. Nobody knew what happened. Nobody was paying attention to what was going on, and I thought, first of all, I thought I should not take my work home with me to the same extent that I do and just enjoy some more time with my kids. But this is a great example of failure of situation awareness in that nobody here appears to be paying any attention to the root cause of the problem, which is the monkey at the end of the conveyor belt. It's not entirely obvious whether this is effective leadership or not. Scott mentioned the TTL role at our hospital. Our TTLs wear a big chef hat too, so that we know who the trauma team leader is. Or if we don't, we probably should. But there's some ineffective strategies there in that he's kind of cupping his hands and shouting down the line at nobody in particular, as far as I can tell. There's probably an issue with fixation and premature closures. This is a psychological concept of sort of fixating on a particular set of features of a diagnosis and not really being able to shift. And again, they're all kind of looking down the line and not at the root cause of the problem. There's some issues with task delegation and cross-monitoring. In fact, the woman at the end of the conveyor belt seems to be the only one who's actually paying attention to the job at hand and trying to get the chocolates off the conveyor belt, which seems to be at least one way to address the problem. And then this issue of role clarity, these three people here just kind of losing their minds and not doing anything in particular. And I don't know any of these people on a personal level, but I would imagine that they're all well-trained and well-intentioned practitioners in the chocolate factory. And yet when any typical set of circumstances presents itself, you might imagine how things go awry. And so we can, again, probably think of times in our clinical practice where a monkey has crawled into our recess room and pulled a lever that we didn't notice, and something like this happens. I would say that the reason I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on CRM is I would kind of describe it as the ACLS of team dynamics. It's important, it's relevant, but I think as true resuscitation practitioners, we need to go beyond that. And sort of the subtitle of this talk was this notion of training the resuscitationist mind. And when you talk about training the resuscitationist mind, I think we know we need to go a little bit beyond just the sort of basic team dynamics, do a bit of a deeper dive into the psychology of performance, which is an area that by and large in medicine, I think we kind of completely ignore. And for the life of me, I can't really figure out why. We're going to talk about three things in particular, and that's the notion of mental practice, the influence of stress on performance, and our environment, our design ergonomics, and how those influence what we do. And to do that, I'm going to need to get into your heads a little bit. It's going to get a little bit weird. I mean, the mitochondrial stuff was a little bit weird, super cool and interesting, a little weird. That's okay, I like weird. This is going to be a little bit weird as well. Insofar as these are probably concepts that maybe you haven't thought about yet in your day-to-day practices being important and relevant, but I would argue that they very much are. I don't know if that mic cut out. Can you still hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. So what we're really talking about is building resilience and building resilient teams. You've probably heard that phrase thrown around a fair bit in popular discussion around team dynamics. And in medicine, there aren't a lot of great models for how to build resilience. You kind of have to look outside of medicine for other models. This is actually a model from system design engineering. It says that effective teams really need to be able to do four things to function in a resilient way. They need to know what to expect. They need to know what to look for. They need to understand what to do when that thing happens, and then they need to be able to look back on that thing afterwards and reflect on that and change their performance. But in emergency medicine in particular, the what to expect thing is a challenge, right? Because we never know what to expect. It's different than a surgeon who can plan for 3 days for a particular surgery and go through that process of preparation and rehearsal. We don't know what's coming next. And so how do you prepare for the unprepared? Okay, so I'd like everyone to just indulge me in a quick mental exercise here. So this is your next patient. You have 4 minutes. But right now, I'm just going to give you about 5 seconds to close your eyes. If you don't trust your neighbor, don't close your eyes. But if you do trust, I'm going to judge everyone here on how trusting they are. Close your eyes for 5 seconds and think about the type of preparations you would make for the arrival of this patient. Trusting group of people. I appreciate it. Okay, that was about 5 seconds. So whether you recognize it or not, what you all just underwent was a process of psychophysical rehearsal or mental preparation on a very shortened time scale. And this is something that elite athletes and other performers have recognized for some time as being critical to improving performance down the road. And this was studied initially in college basketball players. There have been about a million studies like this since that time. In a sentinel study on mental preparation and rehearsal, a bunch of college basketball players were broken up into three groups, a third that shot free throws, a third that just thought about shooting free throws, and a third that did nothing. And the group that thought about free throws improved their percentage to the same degree as teams that actually practiced. I like this video. This is James Harden, who plays for Houston. And in basketball, when you get a technical foul, you shoot a free throw without your teammates next to you. And usually when you shoot a free throw, miss or hit, you kind of high-five your teammates. You go through a routine. It's kind of the same thing every time. I don't know if you can notice, but he hits the free throw, and then he high-fives his teammates who aren't even standing there. There's nobody there, but he high-fives them anyway because that's just his routine. That's the mental rehearsal process that he's gone through a million times in order to sort of keep him in the zone. And the reasons for this are complex, but what it really boils down to is your brain has multiple ways of learning things. It doesn't just involve necessarily doing. And you can learn the same sorts of tasks, at least to some degree, just by thinking about preparing, often to the same extent as you would in actually preparing for that task with physical rehearsal. So this is the same concept of deliberate practice, develop expertise, except it's giving it a bit of a different spin and saying, do you actually need to practice it, or can you just think about or psychophysically rehearse that skill? This is a mental schema or a mental map of skill development in novice piano players who have either just thought about or actually practiced playing the piano in a very guided way. And as you can see, their development is quite similar at day 5 than just the people that have just thought about the task versus, or as compared to the people that actually do it. And this is probably not incredibly surprising to any of you, right? I would imagine that before any of you had ever performed a surgical airway, or even if you haven't done one yet, you've thought about, where am I going to stand? Where is my left hand going to be? Where is my right hand going to be? Who's going to be in the room with me? What's it going to look like? What's it going to feel like? What are my actions going to be? What am I going to ask for, right? There are certain tasks or procedures that we do that are high stakes enough that we've probably physically prepared for or mentally prepared for well in advance. And there is actually a fair bit of literature on this, most of it from the surgical realm, that says that mental rehearsal is as good or in some circumstances perhaps even better than physical rehearsal. The last one there relating to cricothyroidotomy is probably most relevant to this audience. So that evidence is there, and it's actually quite well developed. But the thing is, we're not talking about tasks. We're not talking about procedural tasks. We're talking about this squishy entity of team performance, which has a lot of nuanced moving parts. And so the question that we kind of were interested in trying to address is whether or not this process of shared mental preparation within teams can improve team performance, at the very least as a training tool and possibly as a tool for teams to use to help prepare for complex events. And that's what this paper was from last year. So this was done in collaboration with the Department of Anesthesia at our hospital at St. Michael's. And in this study, we took about 78 residents from emergency medicine, general surgery, and anesthesia, and we randomized them into two-member teams. And it was usually one anesthesiology resident plus one other team member that acted as the team leader. And in preparation for a simulated trauma resuscitation, half of those groups got what we consider standard CRM-style instruction with ATLS instruction and team-based training on how to be a team leader, how to be a team member, what we consider fairly standard training. The other group just went into a room and were told to think about a trauma resuscitation and how they might behave and how they might interact and what they might do. And they were given a script to sort of guide that process. And then we put them through a complex trauma resuscitation and then we debrief them and then we recorded that with our primary outcome being team performance. So how did the team perform as evaluated by two blinded reviewers using a validated teamwork scale called the Mayo High Performance Teamwork Scale? Interestingly enough, the team that just mentally practiced team-based skills did a whole lot better, well, at least somewhat better, than the teams that actually got what we would consider fairly standard team-based instruction. Even though, as it happens, our process of randomization was a little bit flawed, and that mental practice group turned out to be a group of much more junior residents as compared to the group that got standard instruction. So less experienced people did better with a simple process of mental rehearsal, which we thought was interesting. And we've been thinking a lot about what this means, practically speaking. We think it might be an important training tool, so how to make a simulation training session more efficient. Mental preparation is free. You don't need any space to do it. It's cheap because it's free. Said that already. And it can be done in a relatively short period of time. The other possible output is this concept of the team pre-briefing or the team huddle. And we're going to get to this a little bit later when we talk about stress preparation, but we think that there's probably a decent scripted way to have teams sort of mentally prepare as a group in that 4 minutes before a patient like this hits the door that can be very beneficial to how the team performs when the patient actually gets there. So more on that later. Okay, so the next question becomes, what do you do when this stuff happens? And I'll show you a picture that to this audience probably doesn't require any introduction. Everyone kind of remember where they were when this happened? In fact, in this room, some people might have even have been part of this response, I would imagine. I remember where I was. I'm going to date myself a little bit here. I was in medical school, and a guy named Paul Gibson, my classmate, turned to me and said, hey, man, a plane just flew into the World Trade Center. And then a few minutes later, turned to me and said, another one just did the same thing. And I remember that like it was yesterday, and if any of you were around and watching, I'm sure you have equally powerful and vivid memories of when that happened and what you were doing and who you were with and so on. Does anyone have a sense of why? I can't remember what I had for breakfast today, but I can remember that. Do we have a sense of why? It's impactful. Why was it impactful? Did you feel indifferent to this when it happened? Probably not. Yeah, it provoked some pretty powerful emotions. Anxiety, stress, fear, anger, all sorts of things, right? So from what we understand about emotion and memory, at least when we talk about long-term memory, an acute emotion has a very powerful impact on your brain's ability to encode and then retrieve information at a much later date. Because from an evolutionary perspective, when you couple emotion with a stimulus, your brain interprets that as saying, this is really important for you to remember at some point in the future. And it kind of has a print now function on your long-term memory. So it prints it in your long-term memory and it's there forever. And that pairing of emotion and data or stimulus can be a very powerful thing. It's one of the reasons we use simulation, as a matter of fact, because we provoke emotions with simulation. And then we ideally provoke the same sort of emotions that you're going to experience in the actual clinical domain one day when you have to remember that information. And so it's called context-appropriate learning, where you're supposed to bring back information that's relevant to the particular circumstance that you're in. When we talk about stress, I just want to clarify what we're talking about. So we're not talking here about long-term stress or chronic stress or PTSD, which are all very important, but they're a different kind of entity in terms of physiology and output. We're talking about acute stress. So when you walk into a room and you see a neonate and you have to resuscitate that neonate and you're stressed out about that because you haven't done that before or you're scared or it's frightening, how do you keep your stuff together in that circumstance at that time when you need to perform? Those are the sorts of skills that we're talking about here. An acute event that interrupts your performance, interrupts your cognition at a time when you actually have to do something. That's the concern with acute stress, and how do we manage it? There's been a lot of chatter about this in the popular press, in blogs, and on Scott's blog, and in a bunch of other realms, talking about how your heart rate goes up, your performance tapers off, how that influences your fine motor skills and so on, and some discussion that physicians probably have to be somewhere in the yellow zone where maybe you don't have fine motor skills, but your gross motor skills are intact. I put this up here really to say that this is an interesting point of discussion, but probably not a lot of empiric evidence to say that this particular model is true, although it has a lot of face validity. I mean, if my heart rate was 175, I would be voiding my bowel and bladder, most likely. But the real argument around stress and preparation and performance is probably a bit more nuanced than that, and it may look a little bit more like this. Nobody wants to go into a resuscitation feeling exactly as you do right now, calm, relaxed, placid, maybe a little bit bored, and I'm sorry about that. We all recognize that there's a value to being, you know, what athletes call locked in or in the zone or focused. That's a good thing. And experimentally, we can see that because it does improve your performance to be a little bit activated. But there is certainly a point where your performance tapers off and it falls off. And actually, one of the problems we've run into, and we didn't really anticipate this with some of our stress research, is people believe that sort of intended level of performance just goes on and on and on. We will take people and put them through a stressful simulation scenario, and we'll watch them. We'll watch their physiology fall apart. We'll watch their psychomotor behavior. We'll watch their decision-making. We can see that they're stressed. And you take them out into a debrief room and you talk to them about it, and they say, that's fine. And you say, well, how did you look stressed. How did you deal with the stress? And they say, I just ignored it, right? And that's not a terribly productive coping strategy. What they think they're doing is going up on that intended performance curve, and what they're actually doing is falling off. So in addition to being stressed out and having our performance falter, we also fail to recognize how influential that is on our performance. The actual manner in which you deal with acute stress and how it influences your performance probably has more to do with an input-output model and what's called a two-step cognitive appraisal. That is to say, when you're faced with a potentially stressful situation, you have a look at that situation, you do a quick assessment of what the demands are of that particular task, and then you do a little mental comparison. You say, do I have the stuff required, the people, the training, the experience, the skill, to make that thing work, to handle it? And then there's some sort of output, physiologic, behavioral, performance, something. And if your comparison is favorable, if you look at that situation and you say, yeah, you know what, I can handle this, then your performance will go up on that curve and you'll actually do better. And again, we've seen this experimentally. Versus if you feel that the demands exceed the resources you have available, it becomes much more problematic. And we call that the threat challenge appraisal. And again, this is something that we can measure experimentally. So if you see your resources as being in excess of the demands of the particular situation, you'll feel challenged, which is locked in the zone, focused, activated, whatever you want to call it. And if you don't, you're going to feel threatened. And the threat appraisal is the real powerful bit here. And this is why those sort of less nuanced descriptions of heart rate and performance are probably a little bit flawed, because it has a lot to do with the highly subjective process of you evaluating a circumstance and deciding how capable you are. I hope that's Photoshop, man. I hope that dude isn't actually next to that shark, because that scares the crap out of me. But the impact of the threat appraisal is pretty interesting. So in both the threat and the challenge appraisal, you're stressed. Your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up. It's actually part of the reason why heart rate alone is a pretty poor proxy for performance, because your heart rate can go up and you can do well or you can do not well depending on how you evaluate the situation. The key seems to be in the threat appraisal, there's an activation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, and all sorts of neurohormonal stuff starts to kick in particular secretion of the hormone cortisol. And cortisol seems to be very influential in terms of a lot of things, how you make decisions, how you perceive a situation, how you perceive time, what types of decisions you make. Are you going to be a rule-based decision maker? Are you going to fall back on habit, or can you be a bit more analytical? Cortisol seems to be a very important modifier of how you perceive or respond to a particular situation. So that threat appraisal is fairly profoundly important. And again, we can measure this. There are fairly well-validated tools by the people that came up with this concept that allow us to assess out if a person feels threatened or challenged. So in this particular experiment, this was emergency medicine residents being evaluated on a threat challenge appraisal both before and after a high stress or a low stress simulation scenario. And the threat appraisal tool really just evaluates people's perception of the task before and afterwards and says, how hard do you expect this is going to be and how capable do you feel you are of handling it? And there's a little ratio comparison there. And we can assess out if people are feeling threatened or challenged. And again, not really a big surprise, if you're in a low stress scenario, you come out and you go, it wasn't so bad, I can handle that. Versus a high stress scenario where people feel much more threatened. Interestingly enough, these scenarios all involve the exact same clinical tasks. I think it was an intubation and a decompression of a pneumothorax in a trauma patient. But this wasn't my experiment, but the group that did this modified the ambient variables to make a situation more stressful. Noise, ergonomics, a distracting participant, something like that. So just influencing the other elements of the resuscitation, not the tasks themselves, ups the stress level and people feel threatened, even though the tasks themselves are exactly the same. So in a way, this should be looked upon as good news for training. Because, I'll leave that alone. Because your perception of stress, as it turns out, is highly subjective and it can be modified. And we can influence that through training. And that's the whole point of stress preparation training. The idea is not to completely remove stress from the equation. The idea is to help you convert these cognitive appraisals from threatening to challenging and allow you to perform when you need to under duress. That's stress training. So in particular, stress has an interesting influence on teams, and that's really what we're talking about here. And there have been all sorts of interesting studies done by Driscoll, Salas, Hughes, a bunch of others, primarily in combat aviation and two-member combat teams. And what they've been able to show that as far as teamwork goes, once you introduce a stressor, it completely degrades two things that are felt to be really key to team performance. One is the concept of shared mental models, and that really is the team's mental map or mental schema of both their own capabilities and also the capabilities of the other members of their team. What they can do, but also importantly, what their other team members are capable of doing and what they bring to the table. And when you introduce an acute stressor, that concept of a shared team-based mental model is completely obliterated. And again, that's adaptive, right? When you're stressed out from an evolutionary perspective, you're focused on your own survival and well-being and maybe those of your progeny. So unless you're on a resuscitation team with your kids and your family members, you're likely to care less about them and more about yourself. And that does happen as the stress level goes up. And it also interrupts a process called transactive memory, which is very similar to that. And that's one's ability to bring to bear one's own knowledge and experience and understanding from their particular specialty and communicate that and use that to some sort of purposeful good within the team. And so an acute stressor, as far as team performance goes, kind of ruins both of those things. And again, experimentally, Driscoll and Salas have demonstrated this a bunch of times, that combat teams fall apart in their ability to interact or co-orient or share a mental model when you introduce a stressor. This is a really hypnotic video, and I totally understand if you just stare at it for the next 30 seconds and don't listen to me. But what you might be wondering at this point is, if teams are so impacted by stress, and if stress is so intrinsic to the work that we do, maybe it's the team that needs to change and not the people. And you wouldn't be totally wrong in that. This is a pit crew team, and there's this concept that you may have heard of pit crew resuscitation. What that's really representative of is the notion of changing team structure from a functional to a divisional team structure. What that means is rather than making teams really dependent on mental models, having sort of a central team leader and a bunch of followers, as you'd have in a functional team organization, and that would be very much like a trauma team, like the types of teams that we run during trauma resuscitation. I imagine it's probably fairly similar for cardiac arrest and so on here. You change it to a divisional structure where team members have a lot more individual autonomy within their specific roles. These guys are all behaving as a member of a team, but they're acting fairly autonomously within their own set roles. And so this notion of having to sort of share a mental set point or a mental model becomes less relevant because they don't need to, because they have somewhat more intrinsic autonomy. And how we've operationalized this in our resuscitation teams, this comes to bear sometimes in our trauma room, where we'll bring up this concept of mini teams. So a good example would be in a multiply injured patient who also needs to be intubated. Very often a team leader will say, okay, look, between anesthesia and respiratory therapist and one other person, your job is to handle the airway. Here's our initial assessment and plan. You guys go do that, and then we're not going to bother with that. We're going to let you work fairly independently while we address other issues in parallel with that particular problem. So that's the concept of sort of a mini team within a resuscitation team. And that's an example of tweaking team structure to suit function. But it can be a little bit problematic because if, for example, you're working in the pre-hospital setting where you only have two people, or your team is small, or in a circumstance, this works well in cardiac arrest where things tend to be very scripted and algorithmic, even though perhaps maybe they shouldn't be, as Scott will point out. But in a very unpredictable environment like a trauma resuscitation, it can be pretty hard to have roles this pre-prescribed. So it's the sort of thing that we tend to do dynamically, but I don't think it's the sort of one-size-fits-all intervention that's going to solve all our problems when it comes to team interaction. So rather than just addressing team structure, I think the more interesting bit here is how do you address team function and performance during stress? And this brings up the concept of stress inoculation training. Now, what's stress inoculation training? This is just one form of stress preparation training that we've decided to take a look at experimentally. And it's a lot like cognitive behavioral therapy for phobias. So if you had a phobia of a spider, you might set up a 10-session appointment with a cognitive behavioral therapist. And at that first session, you guys might just talk about spiders. And at the next session, they might bring a book with some pictures of spiders in it that the therapist would hold on to. And then later on in the sessions, you might hold that book and thumb through it yourself. And at the end of your 10 sessions, you have a tarantula crawling on your face, and you're good with it. You can handle that. Not just because of exposure, but because over that process of graduated exposure, that therapist has imparted specific management or coping strategies to you that you can apply in an increasingly stressful set of circumstances so that you can prepare. And that's what stress inoculation training is. It's the same idea. The first step looks a lot like what we're doing right now, which is just describing to people what stress does to performance so that they get it, because most people don't necessarily get it unless it's explained to them. Then starting to introduce training strategies, and we'll talk about what we think those ought to be in a sec, that can help people prepare and understand how to apply those. And then this is the fun part for us experimentally. You then take teams and put them through increasingly stressful situations, and through the process of debriefing those scenarios, you start to teach them those specific skills and how to apply them in the real life circumstance. And you talk about difficulties with REBs. It was hard as hell for us to get an REB approval for a study where we said, you know, we're going to just completely destroy residents and teams and stress them out to the max, and then we're going to play with that and just see what happens. So it wasn't an easy thing to do. But that's stress inoculation training. The interesting thing about stress preparation is it seems to be very generic in the way that you can apply the skill. So if you learn, it's not bound by context, apparently. So in the military studies that look at this in cockpit teams, you can learn stress inoculation or stress preparation skills in one context and then go into a completely novel context that stresses you out in a different way, and it's still effective. And I think that's really important for us to understand in emergency medicine, because this can't just be something that you would use in trauma. You'd have to be able to use those skills in all sorts of other novel situations as well. It seems to be durable. These effects seem to last. You have to retrain, but the effects stick around. If you look at Navy SEALs, for example, who all undergo this very specific type of stress preparation training, if you look at their neurobiology, their heart rate variability, which is probably a better marker of the acute stress response rather than just raw heart rate, there are permanent changes to things like their brain DHEA levels and their neuropeptide Y and other neurohormonal changes that are meant to attenuate, in particular, the effects of cortisol on the brain, which is kind of interesting. So you can actually change people's neurobiology this way, and that's in comparison to other military recruits that don't undergo this sort of training. And then it does seem to be a reasonably generalizable skill. So this is a study we have going on right now. And we're kind of doing the same thing in recruiting teams, which are then randomized. And we're going through one of two types of preparation, either what we would consider we have a standard crisis resource management simulation curriculum that we do anyway. And so groups are either randomized to that particular type of training, which we would consider our standard team-based preparation, versus stress preparation or stress inoculation training. And then before and after the course, we're evaluating them using these standardized simulation scenarios. And in the end, kind of the outcomes of interest are both, how do the teams perform? Again, using a blinded, validated scale. And also we're looking at people's biology. So we're looking at salivary cortisol, because it's a bit tough to poke all these people for serum cortisol levels. So a salivary cortisol measurement is a decent proxy for your serum cortisol. Measurements of heart rate variability and something called the state trait anxiety index, which is a validated index that lets us look at how a person is feeling, what their current state of anxiety and stress is, both before and after an acute event. So those are kind of our measures. We're looking at teams, but we're also looking at the impact of this sort of training on the physiology of medical trainees, because it appears to work in other domains, but this really hasn't been looked at in medicine just yet. And this is a brief snapshot of what the curriculum looks like. So the three skills that we've decided are probably most important are tactical breathing, cognitive reframing, and mental preparation, which we've already kind of talked about. We went through a Delphi process with a bunch of education experts to help us decide what was considered, you know, a highly stressful situation. And we looked at both clinical and non-clinical parameters. So an example would be a diagnostic dilemma or a treatment failure or a medication error that you commit. And then some sort of environmental condition like here. It's a bit hard to make out, but this is a screenshot of one of our simulation scenarios. This was a dual trauma scenario. The guy on the right here, and if you appreciate, he's got a rebar sticking out through his leg and a pelvic fracture, and our sim wizard, Roger, has rigged up a pumping artery, so he's actually squirting blood out of his leg and screaming and yelling. His buddy here got blown up as in cardiac arrest and has a tension pneumothorax, which can be easily treated, and the team has to recognize that. All of this happened on site at the hospital, according to the scenario script. So there was an explosion on the site at the hospital, and then somewhere during the scenario, the power goes out. So not to make it any more stressful than that, a dual victim trauma with a power failure. And then there's sirens and noise and alarms and so on. And again, we do this very deliberately, the power failure in particular, to bring out certain elements of team-based communication, and as I'll talk about in a second, cognitive reframing and understanding what's necessary versus what's possible. So those are the types of scenarios that we developed and we scripted based on this Delphi process of ours. The three skills, it's somewhat arbitrary. It comes from a look at the literature. It comes from speaking to experts, people like Mike Loria, a performance coach named Jason Brooks, who works with doctors in improving their cognitive performance. This is a concept referred to as triangle breathing. It's also considered, there's a square breathing version of the same thing. Yoga breathing would be another way to look at it. We call it tactical breathing. That's what it's called because it sounds kind of cool. But those are the people that developed it. And this is really, there's nothing really magical about this particular form. The idea of giving it a shape means that you have something mentally represented in your head that you can think about and focus on to bring you into a clearer state of focus during a critical event. So the idea is that you take a 3-second breath in, you hold it at the top, you take a 3-second breath out, you hold it at the bottom. The second is the notion of cognitive reframing. This would be the I'm good enough and I'm smart enough section of the training. But I actually think it's incredibly important. So in addition to being able to say things like, I can do this, or I got this, or I can handle this, or we've been here before, I think the other really important and perhaps the more important element of cognitive reframing, and that is that notion of self-talk to sort of reorient yourself or reorient your set of goals and priorities, is to understand, as we mentioned a moment ago, what's possible versus what's necessary. So if you think about a basketball team that's down 12 points in the third quarter, like my beloved Raptors, who just got pantsed by Cleveland last night. Ooh, that was ugly. You can very quickly watch these teams fall apart and start to panic, right? Because they're trying to catch up and they figure they have to play defense and they have to get 12 points right now, and that's impossible because only every basket's worth 2 or 3 points at the most. And you can see them panic and you can see their performance taper off. So what does a good coach do, or a team leader or a veteran on the team? They call everyone over to a timeout and they say, look, what we need now is a stop at the defensive end. And then we can worry about, so let's talk about how we're going to do that. And then we can talk about the next play. and scoring a basket. And we're going to, you hear athletes say this all the time, right? One quarter at a time, one game at a time, one series at a time, whatever it happens to be. So in that example of a dual victim power failure scenario, there's only so much that you could actually accomplish in a 15-minute scenario. And if the team is compelled to believe that they have to sort of handle everything all at once, they're not going to perform. But what we teach them is, are there ways that you can sort of talk yourself down to a ledge to say in the next 2 minutes, reasonably and realistically, this is what we need to do and this is what we need to accomplish. And again, that can be a very powerful way of refocusing people's attention and energy on a particular set of priorities rather than trying to handle it all at once, which is impossible, particularly in a situation like that. And then the final one is this concept of mental preparation. So we already talked about this. Mental practice overlaps with stress preparation in the notion of preparatory information. Again, this has been looked at in other areas of stress training. If you can tell people or give people some idea of what to expect, their response to that thing, whatever it is, when it arrives, seems to be a little bit attenuated. And so the mental practice bit comes in providing people with some sort of scripted way to mentally prepare for an event. And there's not a lot of science behind this. This is just kind of what we decided we were going to try and teach. So we're taking teams before they go into a simulated scenario, and we're asking them to kind of run through the script of what information do we have, what's our plan in the initial little bit, first 5 to 10 minutes, keeping it small and manageable. What will we change if that doesn't work? And I think that's a pretty important one. And then who's going to do what? And I would argue that I think we do a decent job of this already within our professions. So if we have a trauma coming in, you know, I think a little bit about, am I going to get a chest tube tray out and what sort of injuries am I expecting and logistics and that sort of thing. And the nurses get their level ones primed and their IVs ready and they kind of talk to one another. I actually think we do a fairly lousy job of getting together as a team and discussing not only what do we expect to see, what do we expect to do and what are we going to do, what are our major contingencies going to be if that doesn't work. So we don't do that team-based preparation very well, and that's what this sort of script is meant to address. And another way to look at this concept of breathe, see, talk, focus. And this is a rubric for the same sort of skills put forward by a guy named Mike Loria. And that's the notion that controlled breathing, mental preparation, positive self-talk, and having some sort of word to focus on, a word or a phrase, his is focus, but it can be anything, are the sort of three or four key things that can help you bring yourself into a state of mind that allows you to focus and perform when you need to. And if all of this sounds a little bit weird and new agey to you, and I understand if it does, it would be important to point out that Mike Loria here is now a medical student at Dartmouth. Before he was that, he was a paramedic for the Special Forces. He describes his job as being the guy that had to go and rescue the Navy SEALs when they got in trouble. And when he crossed over into medicine, his comment was, I can't believe you guys aren't doing this. Like, this is everywhere in military preparation. We understand a bit better, I think, how stress influences our performance. I kind of expected to see this in medicine, and it's just not here. It's not happening. Can't really figure out why. And I think maybe the message is, first of all, there needs to be some domain specificity in this. We can't just export concepts from the military and plop them in medicine and expect them to work. But if it's good enough for the special operations and special forces, it's probably okay for us to buy into this as well, I think. And in the last couple of minutes I have left, I just want to talk a little bit about understanding how to reflect back on what's happened. And this is where simulation can be really powerful in that you do a scenario, you look back on it through a process of focused debriefing, and you talk about what could be improved. This is our trauma room at St. Michael's, and this is our actual trauma room. These are our actual trauma team members, anesthesia, orthopedics, general surgery, that's RT, those are our ultrasounds, our monitors, our equipment, everything that was actually in the room at the time, our nurses. When Dan steps away from the foreground there, though, what you're going to notice is that's not a real patient, it's a mannequin, it's a simulator. And so we've started to run at least once a month for now these full-scale trauma resuscitations as part of a study called TRUST, where we plunk a simulator down in our trauma room and we don't tell the trauma team what they're getting paid for, we just page them and they show up and there's a scenario for them to perform. And these scenarios are built on prior M&M cases that we've identified in our hospital as being problematic in the past. So we call this kind of a living M&M, where we rebuild M&M cases into something that people can practice. And we run each case 2 or 3 times throughout the year, so we get multiple takes on the same scenario. And then we sit down and we talk and we debrief afterwards. But the focus of analysis here is actually not so much the team, it's the environment. So in this circumstance, we're looking at our design ergonomics, our logistics, our equipment, We have a group of human factors engineers as part of this project, and they sit down and look at our process and go, what the? It's a fascinating thing to have design engineers and human factors engineers look at the work you do, because they can't for the life of them understand why we do what we do, whereas we just consider that as routine and what we've always done. So it's very interesting to have that perspective and that take on what we do. And we're getting all sorts of interesting things out of that work, like this. So this takes a little bit of explanation, this map. This was a failed airway scenario that we ran as part of the trust study. And this is our trauma room, and we've taken everything out of the picture except the trajectory of the general surgery resident, who was identified when he walked into the room as being the person who is supposed to perform the surgical airway. It was a failed airway from the get-go. And I don't know if you can notice the timer there. It starts about 6 minutes, goes all the way up to about 18 minutes. It's a time lapse. And this is the course that that surgery resident carves throughout our resuscitation room, looking for stuff, asking for things, looking for equipment, talking to people before they finally settle at the patient's right-hand side to perform a surgical airway. And this isn't to knock the surgery resident. This taps into all sorts of interesting issues about logistics, about communication, about role allocation, about where stuff is supposed to be. If you're a surgeon performing a procedure, chances are your feet are planted at the bedside where you're supposed to be and you don't move, and you're able to ask and request equipment that you need and so on in a very organized fashion. So we look at stuff like this and we sort of dial it back through a process of debriefing and analysis to figure out why the hell somebody performing a surgical airway needs to go through that much walking for that much time before they can do the job that they're supposed to do. So stuff like that, where the environment becomes more of our unit of analysis and not so much the team. So stay tuned, that's in progress as well. We talked about domain specificity, and it's true that you can't just pick up concepts from the military or aviation or athletics and drop them on medicine and expect them to work. You really need to adapt all of these things so that they make sense for a particular domain, emergency medicine, critical care. They're all going to be a little bit different. But I do think that as an organization, groups like aviation have figured out a lot of stuff that we haven't, in the sense that human and organizational and technical abilities all kind of need to be bundled up together. And again, I can't for the life of me figure out why we just choose to ignore a lot of these components of human performance that we know are important. I think part of it is just we figure we can shove it aside and perform anyway. And hopefully some of the data I've shown you might try to convince you otherwise, that you can't, that your performance has a limit, and that we can extend those limits with focused training. We just don't do it. We make a lot of assumptions in training, in residency training in particular, that when you go through a residency program, you're just going to kind of acquire these skills by observation and mentorship and so on. And I think that's wrong. I think you need to give these skills names. I think you need to practice them deliberately and rehearse them to really acquire expertise in them. And for the time being, I don't think we're doing that. So, and with a quotation from another favorite Canadian of mine, this is Glenn Gould, a fairly genius piano player, who said, "We do not play the piano with our fingers, but with our minds," which I think is interesting. When you talk about resilience in teams, I really believe that resilience is built, it's not born. I don't know, I think there was a belief in the past that, you know, people in teams could either be resilient or they could not be resilient. I think that's probably not true. I think there are lots of techniques that we can explore to train teams to perform better during acute events, and we need to do a little bit more of that than we're doing right now. Your mind is a very powerful simulator. You don't need a full-scale simulation lab. Maybe a process of focused mental rehearsal for a few minutes in a scripted way before a sick patient arrives is enough. Or maybe it's not enough, but maybe it'll help. And your mind is one of the more powerful simulators that you have access to. And then finally, stress is going to eat up your team if you just choose to ignore it. And the argument is a little bit more nuanced maybe than we've made it, and I think we still have a lot of ways to go to understand exactly how to train to attenuate that effect, but certainly the effect is there. And the approach of saying, well, I just kind of ignore my stress and I deal with that afterwards, we've seen that to be very not adaptive. And if you think your performance is getting better by doing that, you're wrong. Sorry to tell you. So we need to train that. We need to identify that as a specific skill, and we need to try and understand how to train that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.